The idea of a mass shooting going unsolved in today's world sounds nearly impossible. There's cameras virtually everywhere, constantly recording us. But in 1990, that wasn't so. And for residents of Las Cruces, New Mexico, it's been a reality for over three decades. February 10th of this year marks 34 years since the Las Cruces Bull Massacre. Survivors of the tragedy were able to give a detailed description of the killers. Their police sketches were broadcast nationally, and the case was featured on NBC's Unsolved Mysteries. Yet we still don't know who these men are and why they did what they did. Did they flee to Mexico, just 45 minutes south? Are they in prison for another crime? Or are they still walking among us, sitting in church, going to the grocery store, dropping their kids off at school? That is the answer everyone wants to know, especially the survivors and the family members of the victims. In 1980, Ron Cenac opened Ranchero Bowl in Rio Rancho, New Mexico, a 12-lane bowling alley featuring a restaurant and bar. This wasn't Ron's first rodeo. He owned a construction company, Cenac Development, which had already built various commercial and residential properties. Ron actually employed three of his sons at Ranchero Bowl, Dennis, Steve, and RJ. This family business dynamic was so strong they even put it into their branding. A sign above Ranchero Bowl that read, "The Brothers Three." Unfortunately, the cash flow wasn't enough and the payments on the bank's loans were too much. It forced Ron Cenac to file for a Chapter 11 reorganization of the business in federal court during the summer of 1986. The following May, Valley Federal Bank foreclosed on Ranchero Bowl, but the Cenac brothers were not unemployed for long. 2 years prior, in 84, Ron had opened another bowling alley, about 4 hours south, the Las Cruces Bowl. Nestled on the corner of a busy intersection, the business was massive. It held a restaurant, an arcade with video games, pinball machines, and plenty of parking for customers. Commercial and residential buildings were scattered nearby, but the only thing that closely bordered Las Cruces Bowl was a tire store and a vacant lot. In 1990, Friday nights were some of the busiest nights at Las Cruces Bowl. That's when they held their adult bowling league, and the thousands of dollars they pulled in was kept secure, and the front office locked in a safe. On Saturday, February 10th, Steve Cenac, one of Ron's sons, arrived to Las Cruces Bowl, apparently to get his backpack for class. He'd forgotten to take it home with him the night prior of getting off his shift. Steve pulled into the parking lot just before 7:15 a.m. In less than 2 hours, families would be arriving for the Junior Bowling League for children aged 10 to 14. While Steve picked out a parking space at the front, he noticed two men on the east side of the lot, close to the edge of the building. It wasn't unusual to see people around the area, so he didn't think much of it. The front doors to the bowling alley were unlocked. As Steve made his way to the front office, he passed 33-year-old Ida Holguin, who was prepping the kitchen for the 8 a.m. opening. Ida had only worked there for a few weeks, and she usually didn't work mornings at all. She changed her schedule so she could play bingo with her mother recently. In the front office, 30-year-old manager Stephanie Cenac was counting the cash from the busy night prior. This, of course, is the daughter of Ron Cenac, who owns the Las Cruces Bowl, and the sister of Steve Cenac, who is arriving to pick up his backpack. Her 12-year-old daughter, Melissa, was there, as well as Melissa's friend, 13-year-old Amy Hauser. When Steve walked into the office to get his backpack, he apparently thought back to the men in the parking lot. He reminded his sister to keep the doors locked. They had been open when he got there. And just before leaving for class, he apparently reminded her again, "Make sure the doors are locked." Fast forward a little over an hour. Around 8:20 a.m., roughly 40 minutes before families arrive, Melissa and Amy get hungry, but Ida isn't ready in the kitchen. Stephanie gives the girls some quarters so they can grab a snack out of the vending machines. But when the girls enter the front room of the bowling alley, two men are standing there, holding guns. The older one tells the girls to go back into the office, and the younger one headed towards the snack bar. Ida saw him come around the corner, then put a gun to her side. He told her, "This is a holdup. Come with me." The unmasked men forced everyone into the office and onto the ground. Stephanie, Ida, Melissa, and Amy were huddled together in the small space as the men shouted, demanding to know where the money was. Stephanie opened the safe and started placing the cash in a brown suitcase the intruders had apparently brought in. The gunman then told everyone to put their heads down. Moments later, gunshots. This clip is Ida Holguin recalling her experience.
This guy came in, he stuck a gun on me, and that's when he said, come with me, this is a holdup. And I couldn't even move to the office because I was so scared. I was stiff. He kept hitting me in the back with a gun and told me to go in the office. And when I got to the office, Stephanie, Melissa, and Amy, they were sitting down on the floor, and then they told me to go in and join them. They waited for a while, and then they asked Stephanie for the safe. She opened it, and she was getting money, giving it to Melissa. Melissa was putting it in a suitcase. I saw a suitcase. It was a brown suitcase. They put a lot of money in there. Then they started shooting us. When they shot me in the arm, I didn't know. I thought it was Amy's blood. I thought they shot her, and the blood splattered on me because it was hot. But no, they had shot me. And then they shot me on the shoulder, and that one threw me to the, that knocked me to the computer. And then they told us to all put our heads down. And then they started shooting.
Stephanie, Ida, Melissa, and Amy were all shot several times. But from the outside, no one knew that this terrifying event was unfolding. The building was apparently pretty soundproofed. 26-year-old Steven Turon, the pin mechanics for Las Cruces Bowl, entered the building within seconds of the gunman firing. Steven had recently graduated from New Mexico State University with a degree in criminal justice, and he did all of this while working weeknights and some weekends at the bowling alley while taking care of two children. On Saturdays, while Steven was at work, during the day, his wife Audrey was in cosmetology class. It was difficult for them to find a babysitter for that specific time, so Steven often took them to the bowling alley. This day wasn't any different. Steven walked towards the front office holding his 2-year-old daughter, Valerie, alongside his 6-year-old stepdaughter, Paula. Ida, the cook, and Paula share the same last name, but they have no relation. Steven and his children are immediately confronted by the gunman, who forced them into the front office as well. There are now 7 adults and children crammed into the office, not including the 2 gunmen. Melissa had her head to the ground when she heard the men shuffling, and then a series of quick shots. When it stopped, the men quickly ran out. Melissa called out for her mother, who didn't answer. When she managed to lift her head, she noticed that smoke was filling the room. There was a fire on the desk. Melissa was the only person in the room conscious enough to call for help. Just 9 minutes after the gunman entered the Las Cruces Bowl, Melissa calls 911.
Cruces Bowl?
Yes.
Okay, and there were shots fired?
Yes. All of us were hurt.
Huh?
All of us were hurt. I think I'm the only one conscious.
All of you were hurt? Okay, we'll get an ambulance rolling.
Please.
Okay. What's your name?
Melissa Repass. Please hurry.
Okay, Melissa, we've got them dispatched. Did you see who did it?
No, sir. They told us all to get down. They shot me 5 times.
Okay. We'll get them rolling, Melissa. Just hang on. Take a deep breath. We've got patrol units in route. How many people are hurt?
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7.
7 people are hurt?
Yes, I think. I
7 subjects hurt. Okay. Okay, Melissa.
It hurts.
It hurts. Okay. Melissa, I've got an ambulance and I've got the police officers en route. They'll be with you just shortly.
Okay.
Okay. You didn't see what any of the men were wearing?
Mom, they took all of our money.
You didn't see what any kind of the men were wearing or anything?
No.
Nothing, huh? They just walked in?
Uh-huh.
Do you know if they were black men, white men?
My mom, black men. They're both black.
Two black men?
Yeah.
Okay. No, they've left. Two black male.
Please hurry.
Okay, okay. It's okay, Melissa.
There's a fire, too.
There's a fire?
It's right on the desk. They're going to burn us up.
Are the men still there?
I don't know.
You don't know?
I don't know. They put us in the office.
They put you in the office?
Yes, I need a fire engine, too. Please help me.
And two. Okay, Melissa. She said they locked them in the office. She doesn't know if they're still there or not.
The door's open. There's a fire.
It's on Amador, yeah.
Please
can you
help.
Smell smoke, Melissa?
Yes, I can see it.
Okay.
Can I get the fire extinguisher?
Fire department, too?
Yes.
She says she smells smoke. They may have lit the building on fire.
No, it is on fire.
It is on fire.
It is.
Okay, Melissa.
Can I go
stand
get the...
Stand by, utility one.
Oh, ow.
Okay, Melissa, we've got them coming, hon. We've got them coming.
Is somebody... He's calling my mommy.
Okay, Melissa. There's a police officer there now, okay?
There is?
Yes, there is. He's going to try and find you.
We're in the office. Just tell him.
Stand by at 33 traffic.
Let me see.
Oh, God.
Okay.
I'm going to die. I know
Hold on, Melissa. We've got the ambulance coming. They're just down the street. Huh? She advises all seven are shot, they're injured, they're in the office. Where's the office at, Melissa?
You go in the door, in the front desk, and then you take a right, and we're right in the building.
Okay. She says you go in, to the first desk, take a right, and you're right there at the office. Okay, I'm giving the directions on how to get to you, to the police officers that are there.
Oh, my God, please help me.
They're helping you, Melissa. We've got them rolling. Okay? You've got to be brave. Got to be strong now. Okay.
Oh, God. It's going to burn us right now.
Okay. Can you see flames?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's burning us.
Okay.
Oh, I got bullets in my feet.
Okay.
The bullets in my head.
You both, the bullets in your head, too?
I can't. None of them are talking. I'm still here.
Go ahead. I hear the officers telling you to get out. Get out. Was that the police officer?
Yeah.
To get out?
Yeah.
Then get out.
Okay.
Okay?
Melissa was in such a state of shock that when officers arrived on the scene to rescue her, she couldn't move. She couldn't let go of the phone. The dispatcher and police had to convince her that she was okay now and that she could get off the phone. It was time to leave. And when Melissa finally got up and proceeded to walk out, she said she was too scared to look around. But unfortunately, she did lock eyes on the youngest victim, Valerie. Melissa said this image will forever haunt her. The men had shot Valerie in the forehead. Police and EMS quickly pulled everyone out of the office so they could put out the fire. Not only did the fire destroy some evidence that would have been left behind at the scene, so did the act of putting out the fire. Several of the victims were already deceased when EMS arrived, including Stephen Teron, his 6-year-old stepdaughter Paula, and 13-year-old Amy Hauser. 2-year-old Valerie was actually alive when EMS arrived, but was pronounced dead on arrival to Memorial General Hospital. Ida, Stephanie, and Melissa arrived in critical condition. The gunman had fired 25 shots at close range, nearly all of them at the victims' heads. Within an hour of the 911 call, authorities set up 10 roadblocks around the city. 80% of the city's investigators were working on the case. 120 officers were involved in the manhunt, including local and state police, as well as federal investigators. 6 aircraft were roaming the skies to aid in the search. At one point, Border Patrol stopped four individuals and found $12,000 in cash. Authorities knew the gunman had taken roughly $5,000 from Las Cruces Bowl. By that point, Steve Sinak was the only person who saw the gunman and wasn't killed or injured. They told him they might have the suspects and to come down and take a look. But when Steve arrived and did take a look through the back of a police car, he said he didn't recognize any of the four men. None of them, he said, had been in the parking lot that morning. In a press conference that afternoon, the department's chief of detectives, Captain Fred Rubio, gave an update to the public. Quote, "What we have here is a very vicious crime. You're talking about the assassination of kids, and a whole family almost was assassinated. When they were in there, the office area, there was a smoldering fire and a lot of smoke. They, the assailants, concentrated them in one area, and they shot them in one area. I think what you got here is all the people were hurted and assassinated. We're looking at the motive as robbery. We're looking at the motive that, for some reason or another, they decided to rid themselves of any witnesses. As far as we know, there were no other people in the area at the time. It appears they were trying to burn up the crime scene, and it appears the fire was set after the fact." Referring to Valerie, the youngest victim, Rubio said, quote, "You're talking about a three-year-old. What could a three-year-old testify to? This is why I say it's the worst. What makes it even worse is not only the amount of people who are shot for the amount of money taken. If you start adding up all these ages, you're going to come up with 100 years of life that was just gone by some ignorant people that did this. Was it made this way or was it altered to look like this? We don't know. The facts are those four elements did occur, but we don't know if there's any other motive." Police sketches of the gunman were printed in the paper the following day. The older suspect was described as a Hispanic male, about 45 to 50 years old, around 5'6", medium build, 135 to 140 pounds. He had a dark complexion, dark hair combed back, and brown eyes. He was wearing a green and white plaid sports coat, dark green, possibly brown pants, and black cowboy boots. The younger suspect was also described as a Hispanic male with a dark complexion, about 30 years old, 5'10", 170 pounds, with dark, kinky hair. He was wearing a dark jacket and pants, and possibly a red shirt. His gun appeared to be a 6-to-8-inch blue steel revolver. Audrey Turan spoke with the Associated Press a day after the massacres, a day after her daughters and husband were murdered. Quote, "I want to thank everybody in Las Cruces. I want to thank the police department, the fire department, the detectives who are there night and day trying to catch these guys. I believe Stephen is sending me strength. I believe he and my daughters, my girls, they're all in heaven. God has a mission for them. He, Stephen, took the girls with him because he didn't want to leave them to suffer." Audrey, her parents, and in-laws sat together for a photo holding images of Stephen, Paula, and Valerie. Audrey told the press, quote, "The reason that I allowed this photo is because I want people in the United States to know what guns in the hands of the wrong people can do. They've got to be maniacs to do this. What can a two-year-old do? Why my little girls? My babies? This whole thing is senseless." Audrey went on to say that Stephen wanted to use his degree to go into law enforcement. He was a first lieutenant in the National Guard and had already applied to the Las Cruces Police Department. And despite not being Paula's biological father, Stephen treated her like his own. They even shared the same birthday, July 13th. Audrey said, quote, "The girls were very, very attached to him, and he was to them. It kills me that I couldn't have been there with her. I just hope she was not in a lot of pain. They have something I could not give them. They have peace. They are happy. They'll never cry. No pain. I'm going to miss them. To my dying day, I'm going to miss them. But they're in God's hands. I could not ask for more." Some reports stated that the gunman fled on foot, while others say they may have fled in a gray or green utility van or pickup truck. Either way, Captain Fred Rubio believed they were on the move. Quote, I would think the suspects were mobile then and are mobile now. We're working with a lot of law enforcement agencies in Texas and Arizona. The only thing close to a search in our area is the information that has been given to us about the possibility that the guys are local. We're checking that out too. I believe personally that anybody as cold-blooded to do a thing like this, especially execute a two-year-old baby, these people most probably brutalized somebody before. This was apparently a premeditated attempt to eliminate witnesses. All the leads we have right now are what people and law enforcement agencies are giving us. We don't have any factual data to lead us to any individuals right now. And most of the leads we have followed and looked into have not panned out. We don't know if these two guys are from another country, state, city, or where they're from. Maybe they drove by Las Cruces and decided to stay over. They figured, here we have a city that maybe increases our chances of getting away with something. Within 48 hours of the murders, 17 local investigators were working on the case. Two extra phone lines were opened for tips, and police were getting about 50 per hour. But despite the national spotlight and alert about the gunmen, authorities had nothing substantial. 13-year-old Amy Hauser was buried on February 13th. More than 800 people attended the funeral. Her uncle told the crowd, quote, I have seen this week so much pain in the people I love. So much pain I could hate, but I will not. Amy will continue to give to us, and I rejoice in that gift. The Bishop of Las Cruces described Amy as part beautiful rose and part comet. Quote, they are short-lived. A comet for a brief flashing moment. A rose blossoms and gives a wonderful fragrance, but only for a while. Yet the memory of those beautiful things remains for a long time. The following evening, Valentine's Day, Audrey Turan buried her husband and two children. She spoke to a crowd of over 700 mourners. Quote, I lost my family to two madmen. With your help and support for gun control, let this be the last family that goes this way. The following day, February 15th, just 5 days after the shooting and 1 day after all four victims had finally been buried, Ron Cenac announced that he was reopening the bowling alley. He invited reporters inside Las Cruces Bowl so he could read a statement and answer questions. He told the El Paso Times, quote, Life is for living. We're determined not to allow this insane act of two individuals to permanently alter the lifestyle of the community. Ron spoke the names of each of the victims before reading his prepared statement. Quote, We, the owners and employees of Las Cruces Bowl, will continue to do everything possible to aid the families of this senseless tragedy. Remnants of the crime scene still sat in the building. The charred desk, blackened paperwork, melted electronics. However, attempts had been made to cover up other reminders of the murders. The office had been freshly painted, and brand new carpet was installed in the lobby and office. After Ron's statement, he opened up to questions from reporters. He denied earlier reporting that Amy Hauser worked at the bowling alley. Quote, I don't hire 13-year-olds. Previous reports said that Amy had been working part-time at the bowling alley for about a month, specifically at the bowling alley's daycare center. Reporters also questioned Ron about potential motives, saying the brutality of the killing suggested the likelihood of a gang or planned attack. Ron stated, quote, The Joe Blow robbery I can live with. The planned attack scares the hell out of me. I have no reason to think this was a planned attack. My life is an open book. I run my business and I try to play a little golf. Ron had apparently been on a weekend golfing trip in Arizona when the killings took place. In mid-March of 1990, NBC TV's Unsolved Mysteries began filming an episode about the unsolved mass shooting. Ida Holguin spoke publicly for the first time about the tragedy. By this point, three bullets remained in her body. Her hair was just starting to grow back, and she was relearning to walk. Doctors were planning to remove one bullet from her arm later that week. Two of the bullets still remained in her body, half of one in her brain, and were too dangerous to remove. When Ida recalled the horrific events of that morning, she started with Stephen Turan entering the building, and she said by the time he entered the building with his two daughters, she had already been shot. She heard Stephen yell, "Oh my God, no," and recognized his voice. Ida was going in and out of consciousness. Quote, "I was coming and going. I felt myself drowning. I was drowning in my own blood, drowning in my own blood. After the second bullet, I just started praying. I prayed hard. I heard Melissa scream. I started getting really scared. I started thinking those guys are going to kill us. I don't think they're just going to take the money. I can't understand why they had to shoot. They already had the money. They already had the money. Why did they shoot?" Because Las Cruces is just 45 minutes from the Mexico border, it was at first speculated the men had come from there. However, the older suspect only had a slight Spanish accent, and the younger one had no Spanish accent at all. He spoke plain English. By the time Unsolved Mysteries aired their episode about the killings, the reward was up to $30,000. 312 potential suspects had already been interviewed, and 500 names had been collected by police. Dozens of calls from around the country came in, but police weren't any closer to finding the gunman. Captain Rubio said, quote, "It's not a very good feeling. I don't feel we're close to identifying the suspects." His feelings hadn't changed when he was interviewed in December, 10 months after the massacre. Quote, "I would hate to leave this profession without being here when they solve this. This is a case that haunts us. We're not used to having unsolved mysteries that often." Rubio speculated that the killers were not complete strangers to the area, that it may have been planned. Quote, "They didn't just drive by and say, oh, this looks like a good place to rob. There were other places open." He added that the robbers probably didn't expect so many people to be in the bowling alley because it hadn't opened for the day yet. A lot of people close to the victims came to the conclusion that this wasn't a random incident. The robbers likely knew that Las Cruces Bowl had thousands of dollars from their previous night, and they always counted the money the next morning, just before opening. And if money was the only motive, why didn't the gunmen take all of it? Apparently, they left some cash behind. One of the rumors that started floating around the community was that the owner, Ron Cenac, was involved with some shady business, possibly selling or trafficking cocaine. Again, rumors, never confirmed. Stephen Turan's brother spoke in a documentary about the massacre in 2010. He said Ron was actually living at the Las Cruces Bowl at the time of the massacre. And Stephen had always told him that Ron had weird neighbors and friends that would always come visit him at the building. That Ron was foolish with money, and at points complained about losing a lot of his money. The documentary makers asked the investigators who worked on the Las Cruces massacre, specifically if Ron was telling the truth, about visiting the police department every day for a week after the shootings. And in the documentary, authorities say that was false. Ron apparently made no effort to contact them on his own, and he was definitely not going to the police department every day. It was actually only when officers and investigators reached out to Ron that he spoke with police at all. In fact, at the beginning of the investigation, Las Cruces police had trouble getting a hold of Ron at all. He was uncooperative, even though this happened in the building that he owned, and his daughter and granddaughter were severely injured in the shooting. They nearly died. Ron said he was angry that police were pointing the finger at him, questioning his integrity. An interviewer then tells Ron that a polygraph test was supposed to take place for him, but never happened. Ron fired back that he had actually taken 3 polygraph tests. Another rumor that floated around was that the intended target of the shooting was one of Ron's sons, RJ, and that the gunman may have believed a large amount of drugs was stashed at the bowling alley. Investigators did interview RJ and get a statement, but it didn't go further. They described him as distant, having a blank face, and never giving them more than what they asked. RJ would die from an apparent drug overdose 7 years after the killings, at just 36 years old. Ron Cenac's attempts to get the community back to the site of their worst tragedy, his bowling alley, was a failure. The fresh paint and carpet wasn't enough to get families back to the bowling alley at all. Less than a month after the killings, foreclosure proceedings began. His debts had reached nearly $2 million. Today, that would be around $4.6 million. In January of 1991, the Las Cruces Bowl went up for auction and sold for nearly $500,000. Amy Hauser's mother, Gloria Woods, was there to protest the sale. Her sign read, quote, "Non-payment may have caused loss of four lives. Justice?" suggesting that Ron's unpaid debts may have been a motive. By this point, Ron had moved out of the state entirely and was living in Covington, Louisiana. On the 20-year anniversary of the Las Cruces Bowl massacre, a documentary was released about the case. The El Paso Times printed a story about the debut with some interviews from witnesses and authorities. Here are some of the highlights. Quote, "It seemed to Ida Holguin that the gunmen were unnerved by the number of people who were there, and that they frantically searched the cabinets for something. More than 100 tips an hour were being called into police. They considered three possible motives. Revenge against then-owner Ron Cenac, a retired military pilot who was in Arizona at the time of the killings. Revenge against one of the adult victims, or a grim robbery committed by two men intent on eliminating witnesses." Chuck Franco, an investigator that filmed the crime scene, said this about Ron Cenac, quote, "His lack of cooperation made it seem like, there's more to it than that. The shooters were initially thought to be from Las Cruces, but information later led us to believe that they were from out of state and sent here to do a job." And this article is actually how I found out that Gloria Woods, the mother of 13-year-old Amy Hauser, actually sued Ron Cenac in 1995. I couldn't find the lawsuit detailed anywhere, but during the trial, Gloria claimed that Ron should take responsibility for the bowling alley's unlocked doors. During a short break in court, Gloria went outside to smoke, and Ron's lawyers approached her with an offer, $30,000 to settle the case. Gloria said this enraged her and that she asked them, "Why don't you just slap me in the face?" So Gloria Woods turned down that settlement, but in the end, a jury found that Ron was not liable for the deaths and injuries that occurred. And it was after this verdict that Ron, his daughter Stephanie, and her daughter Melissa moved back to New Orleans, where the family is originally from. Stephanie Cenac's injuries were so severe from the shooting, it ultimately took her life shortly after moving back to New Orleans in August of 1999. With the national spotlight this case received, it's hard to understand why it's never been solved. Sketches of the gunmen have been circulating for decades, and no one has been able to identify them. One major issue is the lack of evidence at the scene. When firefighters extinguished the fire, they also destroyed the little evidence that remained. DNA evidence wasn't available at the time. The public knows a lot, but we don't know everything. I'm sure there are things police have managed to keep a tight seal on. Fortunately, Las Cruces investigators haven't given up. Since 2017, Detective Martinez has led the effort to close the case. While they don't have a DNA profile of the suspects, they do have fingerprints. In 2020, Martinez told the Las Cruces Sun News, "The advent in technology, the difference in technology, it's at our disposal. We just have to find the right piece that will fit into that mold, that will fit into this new DNA technology, this new genealogy tree that we can use. We just have to find that piece, and I'm positive we have it. I just haven't found it yet." Detective Martinez frequently sends new evidence to the crime lab and travels out of state to follow new leads. Quote, "Sometimes I'll send an item up to the lab for evaluation and they'll come up with a profile. So essentially we've generated a piece of evidence from a piece of evidence. And then it's my job to go out and take care of it." to figure out, was this person involved? If there's any association to this massacre, to this individual. I reached out to entities in Rhode Island. I think we had someone in San Francisco help us out on a lead, so it's across the nation. Some months we get numerous tips, and there's really no telling why or what the reasoning is, why people come forward, but they do. So in random months I'll get inundated with them, and some months are a little lean. Martinez gets the most flood of tips around the anniversary of the massacre. Quote, I'm grateful for that, I really am. It allows me an avenue to pursue new leads to follow, because sometimes we get frustrated that we don't have as many leads as we need to have. Anthony Teron, Stephen's brother, told reporters he's still seeking justice, and that Stephen, Paula, Valerie, Amy, and Stephanie should be remembered as people, not just another statistic. He said, quote, hey, they went into the same restaurants we went to. They played in the same parks you did. They lived and they spent time in the stores just like you did. They laughed and they cried and they were people who were part of the community. They're not a statistic. They're people that lived there who didn't deserve to be taken away like they were. I can see my brother. I look at his picture. He's looking at me in my eyes. And I can hear him telling me, you know what, yeah, it sucks for all of us, but bro, do something for my daughter. They did not deserve this. If you have a tip, no matter how small, they can be given anonymously by calling Crime Stoppers at 1-800-222-8477 or online at nmcrimestoppers.org. Thank you so much for listening to this episode, and shout out to the new Accomplice members, Abby E. and Taylor. If you want ad-free episodes, tons of images from the newspaper archive, and early access when available, please consider becoming a Patreon member. It's just $1 a month. Again, thank you for listening, and don't forget to tune in next week for another episode. I hope you all have a good day, evening, or night. Goodbye.